The Annie E. Casey Foundation.
Good morning and welcome to True Talk. This is WMNF 88.5 FM and we're going to be having a great show today. We're going to be talking to Professor Muhammad Al-Masri about an event that took place last week, but we were fundraising for this wonderful station, could not talk about it, the death of the former president of Egypt, Mohamed Morsi. We will also be talking on the second part of the show with the author that we talked to a few weeks ago, Khalid Al-Jabbar. We're going to be talking about what took place in Bahrain a few days ago. Listen to this music coming your way from the studios of WMNF.
طاحت لطول العمر ولع الحطب اذا بقى كده بكيت لي هنود الحمر ايدين ماسكين بالشباعة الى ركديني بشكل دائرة متوقعين يكون بالشكل فائدة صار مع اسلام عرضت مع الدام لناس شبه غاندي وشبه جاكي تشان قاموس باللغات صار غني هين ما بستعمل غير نوتينجو دينيرو وينو ماني مان فزت بلقب عدم اشتباهي بحد مياه لحد ما ده اتجاه الشط يما افتخري بالعمق بفوتش الا القرش سي في واندر بغني وبشوفش ولا قرش كيف تغلبت عالصعوبة هذا الشاب القدر وقفت عتل تشرين لانو حط لي ايجر فوت هالبنكي بجكي لانو حسابي تحت الصفر ولسه ماشي يما بقالي كم من متر
ولا مرة
لا انا بتغير ولا الوضع بتغير تحت السما واقفيني دمتين زي الملايين عم بستنى الملايين
ولا مرة
لا انا بتغير ولا الوضع بتغير تحت السما واقفيني دمتين زي الملايين عم بستنى الملايين دراما بعيون الفنان كوميدية كمثال بالشغل بقوم قرشات عمل لولاد من حارات فقر ما نعمل شي من ولا شي مثل اعلى برشدهم كيف بالقلم يعطوا الالم معنى اولاد جدعان كل حدا بده يصير حدا بيذكروني فيي انا قبل ما اصير انا فبقولهم حبيبي لا تكون لسه بابا وبراسي بقول دبرولي راديو ديسك سيارة.
And welcome back to True Talk. I want to thank all the wonderful listeners out there who contributed to WMNF and to True Talk while we were fundraising last Friday. Our show True Talk, Ahmed and I were able to exceed the goal, actually, and we got more money than we wanted, but it all goes to running this wonderful station where you can listen to an American Palestinian Muslim woman talk about important issues that you may not be listening to on our mainstream media and even some alternative media. They might not even pick the things and the topics that we talk about. So thank you so much for contributing to True Talk in this hour. You can still give True Talk some extra money for all the phone calls that we make, and all this money will not go to Ahmed and I. We are volunteers, just like so many people in this station. The money will go to keep WMNF. So please go to WMNF.org as you listen to this wonderful interview with Dr. Muhammad Al-Masri, and give as much money as you can. We still need to raise about $12,000. But now we're going to move to Dr. Muhammad, who is Muhammad Al-Masri, who is chair and associate professor of journalism and media and cultural studies at Doha Institute for Graduate Studies. He's in the U.S. He was actually born in the U.S. and he's visiting. And he will be talking about, I want to ask him about the death of the former president of Egypt. Good morning, Dr. Muhammad.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Doctor. The passing of the maybe the second democratically elected president of Egypt just happened so quickly, and he was buried, and it seems there isn't much coverage. Can you walk us through the what happened in the prison? In the court. He was in the court. What happened? How did he die?
Yeah, so Mohamed Morsi was the first and only democratically elected president in the history of Egypt. He was overthrown in a military coup in July of 2013 after only 1 year in office. and he was basically kidnapped, arrested, and charged with a bunch of trumped up charges. He was treated very poorly while in prison. I can talk about that in more detail later. But he had a court appearance last week, and he essentially stood up. He said a few words. Reportedly, the last things that he said were about state secrets, that he had some secrets that he said if he were to share them, that it would be essentially very groundbreaking. And then he collapsed in the court. He was left for about 20 minutes without any medical treatment, and then finally he received treatment, and it was too late, and he was pronounced dead. He had been suffering from kidney disease, liver disease, and also diabetes. He was 67 years old, so he was an older man, and he had not been receiving proper medical care while in prison.
So what was the trial about? I mean, what were the exact accusations? What is he accused of? Why has he been in prison all this time?
Yeah, so it was decided very early on that, you know, I guess you could say that the deep state in Egypt, the military, the police, they weren't going to allow Morsi to govern Egypt. And so plans proceeded very quickly to try to overthrow him, to try to get rid of him. And it was necessary, while ending his rule, or ending his term in office, to also completely eliminate him from the political scene. And so a bunch of trumped-up charges were contrived. He was charged with killing protesters. That was an absurd trumped-up charge. It was actually his supporters who were attacked and killed while people were trying to break into the presidential palace. He was charged with essentially espionage for communicating with governments that were allies of Egypt, but then that were subsequently declared enemies of Egypt, like Qatar and the Palestinian government of Gaza, Hamas. There were a couple of other trumped up charges. He was charged with, you know, breaking out of prison. Every single one of the charges was absurd. They were all denounced by the consensus of human rights organizations and political scientists. They were never serious, you know, criminal charges. These were just excuses for the Egyptian government to keep him in prison, because it just wasn't fathomable to them that they would let him out of jail to sort of speak his side of the story.
When the elections took place in Egypt and he was elected and he became president, was it like a transparent legal type of election? Were there any corruption? Were there any outside observers that attested to the accuracy of his election?
Yeah, so it was the only free and fair democratic presidential election in the history of modern Egypt. So yeah, it was a transparent, free and fair vote. There were international monitors. Everyone acknowledged the legitimacy of the vote, including the opposition in Egypt. No one contested the actual result. Now, there were people who were unhappy with the result, obviously, but no one contested the legitimacy. He was the legitimate president of Egypt.
So the reason I asked that is because I remember during the rule of Bush Jr., his calls for democratization and how the Arab world needs to democratize, and when they went to Iraq and bombed the heck out of it and did not find weapons of mass destruction, all of a sudden the mission there was about democratization. So when a nation state really goes through an Arab Spring and elects a president, Don't you think that the reaction of the international community, those who keep pointing fingers at Arabs that are, they're not democratic, they're authoritarian, they have some gene in them that allows them to accept authoritarian rule. Don't you see that there is a double standard here with what happened to him, but also with his death? He met so many foreign leaders, European ones. I remember vividly Merkel, for instance. None of them said anything about his passing, about his imprisonment.
Yeah, I mean, sure, there's a double standard there, but it's also very well known and well documented. In fact, this was all very easily predictable. I mean, you mentioned George Bush. I mean, the Bush administration encouraged the Palestinians to carry out, elections. And then as soon as the election result came in and Hamas was declared the winner of the elections, the Bush administration proceeded to organize a coup. That's all well documented. It was well documented actually several years ago in meticulous detail by Vanity Fair, actually, magazine, and also numerous political scientists have written about that. So that's, it's not particularly surprising that the United States and other Western leaders would call for democracy in Egypt, but then not be happy with the result and maybe work behind the scenes to try to undermine the democratic process. So Morsi came from the Muslim Brotherhood. He quit his involvement in the Muslim Brotherhood when he became president, but he hailed from the Brotherhood, and everybody knew that. And it was unthinkable to many people that an Islamist would govern Egypt, such an important country in the Middle East. And the United States had to essentially sign off on the coup in July of 2013. And after the coup, the United States and other leaders in the Western world failed to condemn the coup. In fact, they embraced it. The Obama administration famously refused to call the military coup a military coup because calling it a military coup would have necessitated that the Obama administration follow American law, which prohibits the U.S. government from sending money and weapons to a government that came to power via military coup. And, of course, the United States sends about $1.5 billion to the Egyptian military every year, and the Obama administration wanted to continue to send that money. After Morsi died, I wrote an article in the New Arab, and I called the article "Morsi didn't die; he was killed." And I think that what happened to him was, murder, essentially.
You mean what do you mean by murder?
Well, because he was known to have very serious medical problems, and he was denied medical care for years. He was. His family was responsible for instance, delivering diabetes-friendly foods and also medications that he needed to live, and they were prevented from visiting him. His family and legal team were only allowed to visit him 3 times in 6 years,
mm-hmm.
So about one visit every 2 years. He was not allowed for his doctor to visit him. He was in solitary confinement 23 hours out of every day. He slept on a hard concrete floor. The conditions in the prison were atrocious, appalling. One of the prison wardens said that this section of the prison that Morsi was staying in is designed such that people go in and they don't come out until they're dead. It's called the Scorpion. It's a section of the prison that he was staying in, and it's essentially designed to slowly kill people. Morsi and many others in jail are languishing, and I think that the Egyptian government didn't want to carry out the death sentence against him because of all the fallout that that would have created, but instead they chose to cause him to die a slow death. And I don't have any, there's no question in my mind that they breathed a sigh of relief when he finally passed away. So, you know, there are more details, but that's the long and the short of it. I think that's why I would consider it murder.
Let me just remind our listeners that they are listening to True Talk, and this is WMNF 88.5 FM. And if you are enjoying this show, you can go to WMNF.org and click on the tip jar and give as much as you can to sustain the station. We're talking to Professor Mohammed Al-Masri, who is Chair and Associate Professor of Journalism and Media and Cultural Studies at Doha Institute for Graduate Studies. I want to go back to the idea of like the West fears an Islamist to come to power. Is it just a person who identifies with Islam, like professes Islam, prays, talks about it, includes it in his speeches, the way, for instance, Erdogan of Turkey is, or the fact that Morsi came out of the Muslim Brotherhood? Is the fear from an organized organization like the Muslim Brotherhood, or it's a general sweeping dislike to any president who comes into the Arab world or the Muslim world who is an Islamist? Which one is it?
I think it's both. I mean, I don't think that they're terribly different. I mean, you're talking on the one hand about the Muslim Brotherhood, and on the other hand, you're talking about Islamism. But in many ways, the Muslim Brotherhood is Islamism in the sense that they are the foundational Islamist movement in the world, the most mainstream, the most popular. They have by far the most members and supporters. They're active in many governments in the Muslim majority world, and so they are feared. And it's interesting, they're not feared because, certainly by those who know, because they're violent. They're not a violent group. But I think the reason they're feared in the Muslim world by autocrats and also by Western leaders is because they would be very difficult to defeat in elections because of their popularity. And, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt is a good case in point. There were five free and fair votes in the aftermath of the Egyptian revolution in 2011. Mm-hmm. And the Muslim Brotherhood won all five, and four out of the five votes were not even close. They were landslides. And that's exactly the kind of thing that many governments across the world fear. They have you know, doubts about what the Muslim Brotherhood might do.
Like in what aspect? In international trade, in relation with the West? Is it like fear of them that they will forcefully enforce Islamist ideas on people, veil the women and ask men to grow beards? Is it about Palestine? What is it that they are afraid of exactly?
Well, it depends on the government about which you're speaking. I think that in Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, for instance, they are two very powerful players here, and they have a lot of sway in the West. They are spending billions of dollars lobbying in the United States and in Europe and in Canada. And they fear the Brotherhood, not because they think, you know, the Brotherhood are violent or extreme or anything like that, but because the Brotherhood would potentially undermine their stakes or their claims to power in their own countries. There's a fear of a sort of domino effect. If the Brotherhood wins elections in Egypt, if they win elections in, you know, in Turkey or in Tunisia and in other places, that eventually this kind of sweeping change, this Arab Spring democratic movement and moment will, you know, eventually make its way to Saudi Arabia and to the United Arab Emirates. So they're playing offense. They're trying to completely eliminate the Muslim Brotherhood from the political scene. The United States and other Western leaders have sort of followed their lead. They've been influenced by them. I don't think that the majority of American power brokers believe that the Brotherhood is Al-Qaeda-like or ISIS-like, right? I've been to Congress. I've spoken in the State Department. What people there have told me is that, no, the Brotherhood is a moderate group. There isn't any particular reason to be alarmed by the Brotherhood, neither on, you know, trade, as you mentioned, you know, economy. They're not the kind of group that's going to go around, you know, implementing some harsh version of Sharia law. So the fears have to do more with, you know, sort of global strategic relations and what might happen with Saudi Arabia and with the United Arab Emirates and with other key allies.
I have to say, Dr. Muhammad Al-Masri, that they are not that popular among a large segment of society in the Arab world, including Egypt. Like, I remember I was visiting Egypt back and forth throughout this time, since the Arab Spring, and then when the military council took charge, and then leading up to the election, and then after the election of Morsi. Lots of people were always afraid. I'm going to paraphrase what they would tell me, that they will change our way of life, like an Egyptian's way of life. And, you know, I do respect their fears, but do you think that they were planning, had he stayed in power longer, that they were trying to change really the nature of the society of Egypt, like they claim?
Yeah, no, they weren't. I mean, I've documented a lot of these myths. In some of the work that I've done on Egypt and on the Brotherhood. But, you know, some of your questions are complicated because it depends on what country, what population.
No, let's talk about Egypt.
Yeah, in Egypt, you're right that there was a year-long propaganda campaign against the Brotherhood that was claiming all kinds of absurd things. They were claiming that the Brotherhood was going to sell out Egypt, that they were quite literally going to sell the pyramids of Egypt to one of their allies, that they were going to give away the Sinai to the Palestinians, that they were going to force all women to veil, and many other such myths. None of these myths were grounded in any kind of substantive reality. Most of them were actually preposterous. They were absurd. But many Egyptians did believe them, and they came to support the campaign to overthrow Morsi. And at the time, it was a popular moment, right? It was a popular movement. But what I mean when I say that the Brotherhood is popular, even after the military coup, after the propaganda campaign, after Sisi came to power, the opinion polling data, the scientific polling data that we have from Pew and from Zoghbi Research Associates, which are the only two scientific polling organizations that have polled in Egypt. The Brotherhood's popularity, even after all of that, after their leaders had been arrested and accused of espionage and all these other things, their popularity was 50%.
Mm-hmm.
So you're talking about a lot of support, many millions of Egyptians who support the Brotherhood, and also many millions who were opposed to the Brotherhood. Egypt is a split society. That's what I've written in my work. It's a very polarized society. The Brotherhood was much more popular, certainly, at the outset of the Arab Spring. After the propaganda campaign, their popularity waned, but they remain popular. And I think that their popularity will probably increase a little bit here in the aftermath of Morsi's death, and in particular because the Sisi regime continues to struggle on many fronts, the economic front, the security front. They have not been able to fulfill their promises, and so their popularity is waning. And
Trump is popular there. Can you explain that phenomena? Because I remember I was in Egypt during just before the election, and people will ask me, who do you support, who you're going to vote for? So I tell them, in America, they don't ask you this question point blank like this, but then they would look at me and say, oh my gosh, you support Hillary Clinton? How could you support her?
Mm-hmm.
She's the one who brought the Muslim Brotherhood to the to govern Egypt, and haven't you read it in her book, which is funny because I read her book and I didn't find that clause in particular. But why is Trump so popular in the Arab world, among some segments, let's put it this way, and in particular Egypt?
Yeah, so this goes back to, again, this is complicated global relations, but it goes back to the axis that I was talking about. So there's this new political axis, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and the Egyptian military. They're the three most powerful members of this axis. They are ardent supporters of Israel, and they're also ardent supporters of the Trump administration and kind of the Western right-wing agenda, okay? And they control a lot of media in the Arab region. And the entire Egyptian media apparatus, which is the largest in the Arab world, is under the control of the Egyptian military. And so it's not surprising, then, that people in Egypt, those who support the military, probably half of the society or so, maybe a little bit less than that now, support the Republican Party in the United States and the Trump administration. Now, as I was saying, I think that that's going to start to change. I think it already has started to change, and because more people are waking up to the reality that the Sisi administration, the Sisi regime, has not been able to fulfill its promises. And this is one of the reasons why the Sisi government has now banned polling organizations for the last few years. They will not allow any Western scientific polling company to come into Egypt. They've criminalized this because they don't want anyone to know what Sisi's actual, approval rating is, his popularity, because in all likelihood it's gone down considerably.
Finally, is it possible to predict what could happen in this part of the world, whether Egypt or the rest of the Arab world? Egypt and some other Arab countries are heavily involved in what's happening in Libya. I mean, do you see that there is a chance for the Arab Spring to revive itself and people try to get more democratic systems through peaceful means?
Well, again, in Egypt, the government has killed thousands of unarmed protesters. They've arrested tens of thousands of people. They've criminalized protesting as an act of terrorism. There's a lot of fear, understandably so, in Egypt. So I think that at the moment it appears unlikely. People are just too scared. However, as the screws continue to tighten, as the economy continues to worsen, Egypt is in the midst of many crises, and in the next few years, there's going to be a major water crisis. There are going to be food crises. Then I think, the possibility always exists of another popular uprising, to combat this ongoing military authoritarianism, which inevitably privileges a small group of elites in the society and kind of leaves the majority hanging out to dry.
I want to thank you, Professor Mohammed Al-Masri, Chair and Associate Professor of Journalism and Media and Cultural Studies at Doha Institute. Thank you so much, Professor, for being on True Talk.
Thank you.
And when we return, we're going to be shifting gear and talking about an event that took place in Bahrain for 2 days with the Prince Kushner, I think, the mastermind of solving the Arab-Israeli conflict. So stay tuned, listen to this music.
عيش في دنيا لو وقت فيها يكفي لغتي ما يفهمها إلا مختل مثلي عيش في دنيا لو وقت فيها يكفي لغتي لا يفهمها إلا مختل مثلي
Bonjour mademoiselle 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 Bonjour mademoiselle Mademoiselle, mademoiselle, bonjour mademoiselle, 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 bonjour mademoiselle, mademoiselle, mademoiselle.
من الجبال والقرى الممتدة على جداول الأنهار هذه هي الرسمة قاعد على الكرسي آخر الرصيف برسم بيبة مبادئ الناس بموسم الصيف قدام القهوة وفيها الميسيو بيعت الوردة يا وين بتضحك له سيجار كوبي وبينادي بيد وفكرته بيحكي معي فطنشته أنا من اللي بيصنع الخيال وبيعيش فيه جن الواقع بيعت الورد تضحك لي أنا اللي مثل الخاتم في الغرفة مع الوقت نسيو ينحو من عليه الغبرة شفت السن تطلع في السما بتشاور دايما بقى صبحها انصدمت من طلب اني ارسمها وهي قاعدة بتشرب في القهوة
And welcome back to True Talk. This is your host, Samar Jarrah, and I think we're going to be ready for the next segment. Let me see if Khalid Al-Jindi is on the air. Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you, Khalid?
Good. How are you, Samar?
I'm very good, alhamdulillah. We spoke to you 2 weeks ago, and you talked about your wonderful book, The Blind Spot, and I see that you are the best person who can actually talk about the Kushner economic thing that happened in the Bahrain. Can you tell our listeners, Khalid, excuse me, the background of this deal of the century, where he said Jared Kushner, the husband of Ivanka Trump, he says that he felt that it is easier to swallow the economic part of the deal of the century before he attempts to reveal the political arm. So what was this deal of the century from the economic point of view?
Well, what happened in Bahrain is the administration put together this very elaborate workshop. It was supposed to be a summit and then later downgraded to kind of a technical workshop, supposedly to look at and generate support for this massive economic assistance package totaling something like $50 billion in projects and grants and economic development programs, mainly for the Palestinians, but also for the broader region. About $28 billion would be directly allocated to Palestinians, and the rest, some $21 billion for infrastructure and other projects in neighboring Arab countries like Egypt, Jordan, Lebanon. That's the theory. That's the outline. The rationale that the administration has declared is basically that a lot can be done economically. They put together this elaborate plan, and this is the first phase of their so-called peace plan. The second phase would be to lay out the political component of their vision, which supposedly is coming in the fall, although we've seen already for 2 years, seven or eight delays. So it's not necessarily clear that it will actually happen in the fall, but that's what they've said. The reality is, once you scratch the surface, you find that this is not really an economic peace plan. It's not even really, a lot of people criticize it as economics first, something that Netanyahu has been pushing for a long time. If you build up the Palestinian economy and you improve Palestinian life, then the theory goes that a political resolution will become easier. But that's not what this is. This is not an economics first plan. Because it all hinges on, the entire $50 billion project would begin to be implemented only after a peace agreement, meaning that Palestinians would first have to buy into the Trump political component of this plan, which they haven't yet revealed. So it's not like they're trying to build up the Palestinian economy in the meantime. It's all kind of theoretical. After a final peace deal is achieved, then we start putting in place these projects. Of course, we don't know the details of what's in the Trump peace plan from a political standpoint, but we do know the broad outline.
So let me just go back to the economic. So you're telling me that all this fanfare and all this meeting, which the Palestinians refused to attend, and was all will be put on hold until they come up with the political plan. Didn't they do this during Oslo, where they, for instance, said, oh, the Palestinians will be compensated and there will be so much investment, which led the people to somehow accept the Oslo Accord, and then they were shocked that it led to nothing and more confiscation, more apartheid wall being built. I mean, didn't they try this approach before?
Yeah, of course. I mean, they tried it, but the Oslo approach was a lot more serious. For one, it had buy-in from the Palestinians themselves. They were, a lot of Palestinians were skeptical, but they were willing to go along with this process because there was the promise later down the road that we would tackle these difficult issues of Jerusalem and borders and settlements and statehood. Of course, none of that actually happened in terms of resolving them, but it had the buy-in of the Palestinians, it had the buy-in of the region, it had support from the international community. This is very, very different in that obviously the Palestinians aren't there. It's a little bit absurd to hold a conference that's supposed to benefit Palestinians where there is almost zero Palestinian participation, either from
private sector
or the business community. Exactly.
Although I think there were like this guy, his name is Jabari, and Palestinians are already like so mad at him, and a few people who think they can make a buck. But what's interesting, Khalid, is the fact that so many ministers of Gulf regions sat with Israeli, not officials, but at least people that usually would not sit with. Was this the aim of it, to break and prepare the masses in the Gulf region that soon you will be having normalization with Israel?
Yes, I think that's the main thrust of this whole initiative in Manama. It wasn't really about Palestinians. It was because obviously the Palestinians weren't there. They completely reject the process. So it's kind of meaningless without Palestinian input. So I think the real goal was to begin this process of normalization between Arab states and Israel. Initially, they had wanted this to be a ministerial-level summit where you would have minister-level representatives from Arab Gulf states, from Egypt, Jordan, and other countries in the region, kind of rubbing elbows with Israeli ministers. And that was supposed to be the kind of gateway to normalization. That didn't happen because countries like Egypt and Jordan downgraded their participation to below the ministerial level. And we know or at least we hear that other Arab states were uncomfortable having that level of political representation at the same time with official Israelis. And so the administration had to downgrade the project from a summit to a workshop and decided not to invite the Israeli government. So I think the main effort really was directed at normalizing Israel in the region. But I think it's, in terms of the Palestinians, it's also aimed at normalizing the occupation. Because even though the administration hasn't released the details of its political plan, in a way it doesn't have to, because we already know the broad outline, which are, there's no Jerusalem as a Palestinian capital. That's been taken off the table, and those were the words of President Trump. The refugee issue, they've cut all funding for UNRWA. They're trying to redefine Palestinian refugees, basically to define the refugee issue out of existence. And they're talking about settlements are not a problem. They've removed the word occupied and occupation from their internal reports in the State Department. And so this isn't an attempt to end the occupation, like even the failed efforts of previous administrations were at least trying to end the occupation. This is an attempt to basically normalize Israel's occupation while making life supposedly better for Palestinians materially through these, you know, this promise of all this economic benefit.
Which brings me to, let's, like, if we want to dissect it, and I have read it, these people either have never been to the West Bank and Gaza, or have not even used Google to Google geography or to Google any facts. So, for instance, they want to have this natural flow of goods. How on earth are these goods going to fly by drones, for instance? Is Amazon going to be delivering these packages to the Palestinians across the wall through these military checkpoints? I mean, when you read it, you find it's laughable. It's hilarious.
Yeah, it's true. And I think that's the general consensus among analysts, is that it's a plan. It's not really even a plan, because it has no, it doesn't lay out any mechanism or means for implementation. It just sort of lays out, here's what the end picture could look like, but it doesn't tell us how do we get from where we are now to then. So they talk about transforming the West Bank and Gaza into an economic hub and a financial center like Dubai or Singapore.
Singapore, and and they say it will be a tourist attraction. What, they want to go and watch the people of Gaza dying from hunger and cancer, and they have no hospitals, no treatments, nothing, no fuel. Farmers can't go a few miles into the sea, and or fishermen. I mean, it's...
Exactly.
I don't mean to laugh at it, but it's laughable.
No, I think you're right. I think it is totally laughable. It's completely divorced from reality. And by design, it's not ignorant. It is by design. So it's not as if they don't know that Israel controls the airspace and the borders and movement even within the West Bank. They understand that. But this is a plan that is designed not to reverse any of those things, but to work around them. And I think that is what is really so insidious about this plan, is that I think the logic seems to be that by adding lots of zeros at the end of the dollar figure, $50 billion is a huge amount. John, you know, just by comparison, John Kerry's economic package in 2013, which did have the support at least of the quartet and some others in the region, it was only $4 billion of an economic aid package, and it was still criticized by the Palestinian business community and others as being unrealistic, and it didn't deal directly with the main impediments to Palestinian economic development, which, as the World Bank and the United Nations and the EU and others have consistently found, is the Israeli occupation. That is the number one impediment to Palestinian economic growth. But this plan deliberately avoids dealing with Israel's occupation. You know, just to give you an example, so they lay out this vision for the West Bank and Gaza to become something like Singapore or Dubai. But of course, Palestinians have no airport and no seaport. The way around that isn't to press the Israelis into a rebuilding or reopening the airport in Gaza, or to allow a seaport or anything like that, but instead to use the facilities, airports, and seaports of neighboring Arab countries. So in answer to your question, how do they envision getting around things like the wall and checkpoints? That's how they envision getting around those obstacles, is by letting others in the region pick up the slack. So the responsibility is on neighboring Arab countries to facilitate those processes.
So for instance, for Gazans, in order to be able to import and export, Egypt has to build, finance the trade routes in the Sinai so they can get into the Cairo airport and Alexandria.
Like or Al Arish airport or something nearby Gaza. But it's really a plan that's aimed at solidifying the status quo.
Mm-hmm. Making it easier.
Right.
Let me just, Khalid, remind our listeners that they're listening to True Talk on WMNF, and I am talking to Khalid Al-Jindi, who is the author of The Blind Spot, which reminds me, Khalid, every time I read the comments from Kushner after the end of the conference and Greenblatt and all these people, they go back to what you wrote in your book and how you documented maybe since 1917 the U.S. Official and non-official approach to the Arab-Israeli conflict and how they continuously sided with Israel and flourished on the division among the Palestinians, and they thought it was an asset to pursuing peace, which I don't know how they can think of that. But the continuous repeating of this phrase, the Palestinians never miss an opportunity to miss an opportunity. Do you think the Palestinians were wrong in refusing to attend this conference?
I mean, it's pretty clear that this conference offers almost nothing for Palestinians because, as I said, all of these promised benefits would come after a political agreement is signed. And, you know, at best, we don't know the details of what's signed. And so how would you buy into this without knowing what you're signing up for? But at worst, and this is my view, we already know what the political vision of this administration is. No statehood, no end to occupation, no refugees, no capital in Jerusalem. And instead, they will get some sort of expanded autonomy, better living conditions with, you know, economic aid and development projects, but more or less a permanent occupation. And so I think it's entirely reasonable. I mean, it's perfectly logical to understand why Palestinians would completely reject this. Because it requires, the cost of buying into this is basically to abandon their goal of living in freedom. And that's simply, I think, something that no Palestinian leader of any political or ideological type would be willing to accept. And so this is one of those rare moments where Palestinians are actually quite united in rejecting this entire initiative.
Let me, Khalid, ask you about the Lebanon, like they inserted Lebanon. And I'm thinking, okay, fine, you want to have some sort of an agreement with Lebanon and investment. What happens to, for instance, Hezbollah? That is a very, very powerful player in Lebanon. What happens to Hamas in Gaza? A very powerful player, whether you support them or you don't support them. But these things, our entities, do exist, especially in Lebanon. Like, did they talk to anybody in Lebanon, or they're just planning things for Lebanon?
Well, obviously, they haven't really consulted many people in the region other than the Israelis. And Lebanon officially boycotted the Manama workshop. So, but I'm not convinced that they even expect this plan to succeed or that they even want this plan to succeed. I think this plan is a pretext. It's a pretext for normalizing Israeli-Arab relations. It's a pretext for delegitimizing the Palestinian leadership and Palestinian political aspirations in general. We see that in everything that they do. Jason Greenblatt is on Twitter constantly harassing and trolling Palestinian leaders. It's really quite remarkable. I've never seen anything like it by a diplomat of any type who behaved that way. And it's fairly clear from the decisions that they've taken, from Jerusalem to cutting off all aid, that they're not interested in the well-being or the interests of the Palestinians. They're really interested in kind of making the Palestinian issue go away, either by throwing money at it or allowing Israel simply to continue the occupation. But they are actively working. You know, they spend more time delegitimizing the leadership of Mahmoud Abbas and the PA,
who doesn't have really much legitimacy.
Than they do Hamas.
Yeah, but they don't. He doesn't have that much legitimacy among Palestinians. Why are they wasting their time on Mahmoud Abbas? And they know that the Palestinians can simply go to the streets and have an intifada.
Well, they seem to believe that they can go over the head of Palestinian leaders, and that if Palestinians see what's in the plan, that they will like it so much that they will kind of overrule their leaders, which is extremely naive and completely uninformed. If anything, the Palestinian public is much more skeptical of the Trump administration and America's role in general than the Palestinian leadership. So it's either that they don't really know what Palestinians think, or more likely, they don't know and they don't care, because this isn't really about the Palestinians. It's about Israel, normalizing Israel, normalizing the settlements, normalizing the occupation, and just trying to keep the Palestinian issue kind of pacified.
I'm curious, Khalid, to know, is this purely coming from the White House? Is the State Department involved? I mean, we have career employees in the State Department who sometimes differ strongly on the way the U.S. deals with this issue. Is this just purely a White House-based kind of treaty or conference?
It is White House-driven, but it's also it's personality-driven. So one of the key actors, and I think we could make a good case that he's probably the most influential figure in this whole mix, is David Friedman, the U.S. ambassador to Israel, mm-hmm. who is technically part of the State Department because he's an ambassador. And he's the one who is really driving this effort. He talks about Judea and Samaria and not the West Bank. He talks about the so-called occupation. He has forced the State Department to remove the word occupied from its official reports on the West Bank and Gaza. So ideologically, it's being driven by people like David Friedman. Mm-hmm. It's clear that there's very, very little input from the career diplomats and career civil service and the intelligence community in terms of the substance of this, because I know many of these individuals, I'm sure you do. We know historically the State Department and the CIA have a very sober assessment of the reality on the ground. And they have had for many, many years, as I lay out in the book. Since the 1970s, the mm-hmm. CIA and State Department have been saying things like, we need to recognize Palestinian political aspirations in one form or another. And so this really is a process that's driven by Jared Kushner, Jason Greenblatt, and David Friedman, all of whom are deeply ideological. They have strong views about greater Israel, and they have close ties to Israeli settlements.
We're running time out of time, Khalid, but one final question in a minute. Why the political aspect of this deal has not been out? Is it because they're waiting for Netanyahu to be the prime minister of Israel before they start?
That's part of it. I think part of it is Israeli politics. They're waiting for the right moment. But I think another part of it is that the political component is relatively minor. Compared to the economic component, compared to security, compared to, in terms of the overall vision, the political component is like I said, we already know the main pieces of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's not much left there to the imagination. So there's a theory among a lot of scholars and analysts in Washington that there really isn't a political component, that it's all kind of smoke and mirrors. And there may be something to that. But whether there is or isn't an official plan with, you know, document with lots of words on it, I think it doesn't matter, because the reality is that the plan is to normalize the occupation, and that's already moving ahead.
Thank you so much, Khaled El-Jindi, author of The Blind Spot, for being on True Talk, and thank you for listening and supporting WMNF. You can always go to WMNF.org and click on the tip jar and give True Talk and other shows. NPR News should be coming any minute soon. This is WMNF 88.5 FM.